You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. I let that Harry Connick Jr. selection go all the way through today. We have a little time, and I thought I'd let you hear the whole thing. Today on Write the Book, you're going to hear an interview from the archives with Canadian mystery writer Louise Penny, whose latest book, A Trick of the Light, has managed to find its way onto many best-selling lists, including the New York Times bestseller list, Publishers Weekly, the Chicago Tribune, and the Washington Post bestsellers list. Louise Penny worked as an award-winning journalist for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, among other news sources, before writing crime fiction. Her first Armand Gamache mystery, Still Life, won the New Blood Dagger, Arthur Ellis, Anthony, and Barry Awards, as well as the Dillis Award for the book that the members of the Independent Mystery Booksellers Association most enjoyed selling. Her second in the series, A Fatal Grace, won the 2007 Agatha Award for Best Novel, as did her third, The Cruelest Month, which was also nominated for the Anthony, Barry, and McCavity Awards. Her fourth, A Rule Against Murder, was a New York Times bestseller and one of the book list's top 10 crime novels. A Trick of the Light is her seventh book in the series. Louise Penny lives in a small village south of Montreal with her husband Michael. I spoke to her in early 2010 in a setting that could have inspired a mystery. We sat before a cozy fire in the library at the Essex Inn and Spa, and we discussed her fifth Inspector Gamache mystery, The Brutal Telling, which was published by Minotaur Books in 2009, Minotaur Books being a division of the St. Martin's Publishing Group. I began that interview by asking Louise Penny a somewhat general question about writing mysteries. Does she write knowing what is going to happen?
Yes, I do. I do it less so now. When I first started, I started Still Life, and that took me about 3 years to write, because I didn't know what I was doing. I was kind of bumbling along. I did a lot of planning for Still Life, but because I think that ended up being the template for the whole series, so I think I needed to do that kind of planning with figuring out who the characters were and what the village looked like, and I have blueprints of all the that I've sketched of not only the village of Three Pines, but the houses that people live in. But in terms of the arc of the story, yes, I knew then in Still Life quite closely what the plot was, who done it, why they did it, and all the red herrings. I have at home the notebook. I carry around a notebook for each book has its own notebook, and it's one of those divided ones. So it's got, I think it's five sections, and each section has a title, plot, character development, quotes, odds and ends.
Okay.
I can't remember what all of the divisions are, and they change, of course. And the Still Life one is really, it's really well-worn and thick, and because it's clearly I've made a lot of notes.
And you've probably gone back to it.
Well, actually I have, yes. Well, it's interesting because I went back to look at the character names, and the character names changed. Gamache, who's my main character, wasn't his initial name, and it's really actually quite humorous to look back. Now I find that I plan a lot less.
Was it his initial name when you published the first book?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was.
So you changed his name before you published.
Yeah, and there were a lot more characters, and I got a gazillion refusal letters. It's mostly it's silence, but every now and then a publisher or an agent was nice enough to send a no, which was quite exciting actually, through the mail. That clearly misspelled yes, but at least I got something, some human. But one publisher who turned it down sent me a note, and he had actually read the whole thing, which on the one hand was very upsetting because he read the whole thing and still thought it was crappy enough, he didn't want it. But he was kind enough to send a critique. Now, this isn't the final version of Still Life. It was an earlier one. And he said that beginning writers make three mistakes, generally. There are too many characters, it's too long, and there are too many ideas. And he said, you made all three. So I went back and I cut it. I initially cut it, the characters by about a third. And that looked, to a degree, after the length problem. forced me to look at his question. His issue of too many ideas annoyed me because I thought, no, there aren't. This book is perfect. The more I thought about it, once I got over my anger, I realized that he's probably right, and that I need to figure out what the book's about. Mm-hmm. And that there can be ancillary ideas, but there needs to be a taproot. There needs to be a main theme
right.
to the story. And once I figured out what that was, that guided my hand in terms of the editing. I was able to do, I think, much more thoughtful editing that highlighted the theme and allowed it to come out and sharpened what the theme actually was. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But now, to get back to your story, your question. I do less planning now, but I still, it's a balance, you know, and sometimes I don't do enough and then I bumble along and the process is more painful. And sometimes I overplan and there isn't enough room for inspiration. Mm. So I'm always struggling with that balance. Mm-hmm.
Well, before we talk any more, let's talk about The Brutal Telling for anyone who hasn't read it. If someone who hadn't read the book asked you to describe it, what would you say?
Well, it's a murder mystery, but it's not really about murder. It's about what it's like to live in the pale, inside the pale, and beyond the pale. It's about belonging. It's about greed. It's about what you would do if you were handed everything you've ever wanted in your life. Everything. Everything you've ever dreamed of, and all you have to do is betray a friend. Mm. And they'd never know. They would never know. And there's the major theme in the book with Olivier and the dead man and all that issue of greed and the betrayal. And then there are the minor notes with some of the smaller characters, Clara, who's an artist, and some gay characters, and how their friendships evolve and how easy it is to just to excuse yourself bad behavior. Mm-hmm. And the little lies we tell ourselves that allow us to get out of bed in the morning and look ourselves in the mirror. Mm-hmm. And how they eat away at us over the course of time. I think that's what... But it is definitely a classic murder mystery. So writer Sarah Weinman, who writes for the Los Angeles Times, and she also does a blog, a wonderful blog called Confessions of an Idiosyncratic Mind, and she described my books as neoclassical. And I like that because I think a lot of people are sort of struggling to try to figure out where they fit into this genre. As you know, it's not enough to have a genre, they have to have subgenres, which right. I think is ridiculous to have a genre anyway, never mind subgenres. But I like the idea of being neoclassical because it's definitely in the Agatha Christie. We were sitting here in this wonderful library
right.
in front of a fireplace, and before we started we were laughing about how this is the perfect Christie-esque location
right.
and let's hope one of us doesn't drop dead. And if they do, let's hope it's you. But while I was inspired by Christie, they aren't meant to be blueprints. That's not the template. It's mm-hmm. meant to be brought up to date.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of reviews and Agatha Christie, you've been compared to Agatha Christie
yes.
by reviewers. How do you feel about that? That must be kind of flattering.
It is. That was definitely, when I started to write Still Life and I started to think about it, that was absolutely what I was aiming at, was because I love Agatha Christie. I have tons, I'm still buying them thinking that she's, you know, I see one untitled that I don't know and I buy it. Of course it's some old one I bought and they retitled it and reissued it. And why I think she's still putting them out is beyond me. She's been dead for 50 years. Denial wide and deep in me. But I love Agatha Christie. And Agatha Christie gave me a lot of comfort whenever I was feeling ill or ill at ease or unwell in any way. Or the world hadn't been as kind as I thought it might be. Or I hadn't been as kind as I might have been. I'll take to my bed and with my gummy bears and my Diet Coke and an Agatha Christie. And I will lose myself in that world that is both gentle and menacing. Mm-hmm. And I can't explain what the quality is that she has that I love and clearly hundreds of millions yeah. love as well. But I thought I was going through a period in my life too where I was just, I think I was just tired and a little fearful. It was after 9/11 and the world was looking different. And I thought, if I need a place to escape to, one thing I've learned in my life is I'm no different than anyone else. And if I'm feeling a certain way, then there's a pretty good chance, not everybody is, but other people are as well. So I thought, if I'm reacting like that, then maybe others would like a place to escape to as well. A place where kindness counted and, mm-hmm. and friendship was important. And so that's when I created Three Pines, which is my little village. Mm-hmm. Absolutely inspired by Christy. I adore being... When I'm compared to her, I know that I've done something right. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I do not see my Gamache as Poirot at all. I think...
I actually didn't think so either.
No. Why didn't you? What was...
I see Gamache as being a lot more outwardly functional. You know, mm-hmm. Poirot seems sort of like a sickly little man.
With his little egg-shaped head and his mustaches.
So that was my first reaction. It just didn't...
I think the comparison, I think, is facile because it's... You look at a middle-aged man investigating crime with a French accent in a traditional mystery, and you immediately think, and I can understand why you would immediately think of Poirot. The other, and I think it's a slightly more legitimate comparison, is there's a... In fact, I'm rereading one of the books now, a French writer named Georges Simenon, who wrote a gazillion books, highly prolific. They really would be considered novellas today, but brilliant, really crystalline in their clarity. He's a little bit like Josephine Tay, who was a British author, in terms of the length mm-hmm. and the clarity and the beauty of what they wrote. His main character is Maigret. He was writing in Paris in the 1950s, mostly. Okay. I think Gamache is a little bit like Maigret, although Maigret was a little more doer. Whereas Gamache is really, he's a happy man.
Yeah.
He's a thoughtful, he loves to walk, he loves poetry, he loves his wife loves him. Mm-hmm. And he's content with his life, not in a lazy kind of, well, I've done my thing, now I can put my feet up. But a man who is... who's happy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that, I don't think Poirot is unhappy, but I don't know that you get to know him, his interior life,
right,
very well.
Right. I can tell from reading this that you're very fond of Gamache.
Mm-hmm.
Of the many things that struck me about him, two really stood out. One is that he's an advocate for outsiders and underdogs. For example, he invites Agent Morin to join the investigation. I thought that was a great moment.
Thank you.
Yeah. And he's also, he's accepted in the village of Three Pines
mm-hmm.
as almost like an honorary resident, which I don't think small towns tend to do for people who've come from the city to investigate crime.
Probably not.
So I think that says something about who you'd like his character to be.
Yes.
To be accepted in that way.
Well, yes, exactly. And who I would like Three Pines to be. And this is all hyper-idealized.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted Three Pines to be a place that was inclusive, mm-hmm. but accepted outsiders and didn't make that distinction between belongers and outsiders.
Mm-hmm.
I think every place does, naturally, but I wanted Three Pines to have that sense of being home, that when you arrived there, and not everybody themselves feels it, that they belong, but those who do are welcomed and allowed to live there, and their foibles are accepted.
Right.
And I also thought quite long about this because it would have been, again, quite easy to go the stranger in a strange land route
mm-hmm.
with Gamache
mm-hmm.
so that he would be the outsider coming in and looking at all the foibles.
Which is sort of Poirot-like.
That is, and it's what most investigators do. They
right.
come in and they stand apart. And they look, and here are these kind of country bumpkins who are leading their diminished lives,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
diminished by city standards. And I didn't want that. I wanted Gamache to be also, as accepting as Three Pines is, I wanted Gamache to also be respectful
mm-hmm.
of these people and not see them as anything less than he is, as equals. He wanted, he needs to see people as equals. And he describes, I think it's in his personality, but it also helps in his investigation because he collects, like any other modern detective, he collects DNA and evidence and physical evidence and
right.
all that, and they get sent to the lab and all that sort of thing happens. But more than that, Gamache collects emotions
mm-hmm.
because he feels that that's actually where the murder began, was with an emotion that went wrong, and how best to handle, to deal, collect emotions than to get to know the people.
There was actually a moment in the book that I really loved. along those lines. Isabel Lacoste is talking to the new agent, Morin, and she's considering a lesson Gamache once taught her that she's now going to pass along to this new agent. And she thinks to herself, to find a murderer, you follow clues, yes, but you also followed emotions. And then in the next chapter, as if to prove her point, we have Gamache reacting to someone new that he's just met. And I'm going to leave the name out just so that I'm not ruining anything.
Thank you.
There was something edgy about him, not nervous so much as needy. He wants my approval, thought Gamache. So there, right in the next chapter, you show us the inspector actually following emotions, just as we've just learned from Isabel Lacoste that he likes to do this and that this is how he pursues his investigations. And I thought that went together beautifully.
Yeah. Thank you. There was a section there, too, you talk about Morin, Agent Morin, Paul Morin, who's really a local Sûreté officer. It's the Sûreté de Québec is what Gamache works for. And Gamache is the senior one, and he's in charge of the whole homicide, and Morin is nobody, a tiny little agent who's helping them set up
brand
the incident room, along with a whole bunch of other agents. But Morin has the guts to say, I would like to join your team for this investigation.
Right.
And Gamache's second in command says, no, that's ridiculous. And he and Gamache get into it and they discuss it. And at one stage, one of them said, well, I think we should, because he looks a little lost, like a puppy. And Beauvoir's response is, well, this isn't the Humane Society.
Mm-hmm.
And then Gamache says, it actually, you think not.
And I also liked how Beauvoir is, he's a little bit of a foil to Gamache's personality, to let us sort of see the two of them bounce off of each other. And yet they work well together, but you can sort of just see what Beauvoir still has to learn by putting him up next to Gamache, you know?
Yes, and but at the same time, he's the more rational of them, and yes, so it's, thank you. I like that as well. I think the danger for me as a writer with Gamache, and that I'm keenly aware of, is not to make him too good to be true, that he needs to, and he does make some mistakes and misjudgments, and he has some personality quirks as well, and in some cases, Beauvoir's right to call him on it, but
right.
I think Gamache trusts his own judgment a little bit more than he probably should.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we talk anymore, why don't, if you don't mind, would you read from the book?
Great, I'd love to.
Okay.
I'm going to read a section from the very, very beginning, the opening chapter. And it's a relatively short section. It's the book opens with Olivier, who's one of the ongoing characters in Three Pines. He's the owner of the bistro, along with his partner, Gabri. And Olivier is sitting in a remote cabin with a hermit, and they're over a fire, and a story is being told, and it's a particularly dreadful, it's like a myth, almost like when you sit around and you talk about Bigfoot or one of these campfire, these horror stories, but the story is being told. And then it comes time for Olivier to leave. And so I'm just going to read this last, and this is how people who have never run into Three Pines before, this is the first, the introduction of Three Pines.
Okay.
Be careful, said the old man, quickly scanning the night sky. Then before closing the door, he whispered the single word that was quickly devoured by the woods. Olivier wondered if the hermit crossed himself and mumbled prayers, leaning against the door, which was thick, but perhaps not quite thick enough. And he wondered if the old man believed the stories of the great and grim army with chaos looming and leading the Furies, inexorable, unstoppable, close, and behind them something else, something unspeakable. And he wondered if the hermit believed the prayers. Olivier flicked on his flashlight, scanning the darkness. Gray tree trunks crowded round. He shone the light here and there, trying to find the narrow path through the late summer forest. Once on the trail, he hurried, and the more he hurried, the more frightened he became, and the more fearful he grew, the faster he ran, until he was stumbling, chased by dark words through the dark woods. He finally broke through the trees and staggered to a stop, hands on his bent knees, heaving for breath. Then, slowly straightening, he looked down on the village in the valley. Three Pines was asleep, as it always seemed to be, at peace with itself and the world, oblivious to what happened around it. Or perhaps aware of everything, but choosing peace anyway. Soft light glowed at some of the windows. Curtains were drawn in bashful old homes. the sweet scent of the first autumn fires wafted to him. And in the very center of the little Quebec village, there stood three great pines like watchmen. Olivier was safe.
That was Louise Penny reading from The Brutal Telling, which was published by Minotaur Books just this, well, 2009.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
2009. Thank you very much for reading
that.
Thank
you.
Starting out with that story within a story, that kind of continues through the book a little bit. So what do you think it is about a story within a story that's so appealing to us as readers?
Well, that's an interesting question.
Because I think it's really very appealing to readers.
Well, thank you. I hope so. I think the challenge as a writer is not to have it take away from the propulsion of the book or to have it more interesting than the other story of the real book. What I found fascinating is I love myth. I love mythology. So I read a lot of the Campbell books and on myth. And the
Hero with a Thousand Faces.
That's right. And the different paradigms that we use for myths and storytelling. So I don't really know. What do you think is the appeal of the story within a story?
Well, one thing that struck me was seeing how the hermit reacted to the story being told to him, and in a way you can sort of see the characters hearing a story, which is an interesting dynamic, really, because instead of them just being a part of a story that you're participating in, you get to sort of watch them. Anyway, I don't know. I enjoyed it.
Good. I'm glad. It took me a long time to figure out what the story was that was being told.
Right. And that story becomes almost a clue or a hint.
It is.
It
parallels
threaded through
the actions, exactly.
There are certain clues that help the inspector along, things like the story within a story. Well, that's sort of for us more, but the carvings and the codes and things like that. And I'm just curious if you can talk a little bit about offering clues and hints for readers. Do you enjoy the idea that readers are going to be trying to figure this out as they go?
I do. There are different types of, as we've talked about before, the subgenres. And the one that I've always read and always loved was the puzzle mystery where... Mm-hmm. And that's very classic, where at the end when you're told whodunit, you realize that you should have been able, and you could have.
Right.
And that's being true to your audience. You're not tricking them. However, there are some sleight of hands that you use. There's misdirection, and there are red herrings.
You mentioned the red herrings, right.
Yes, and all those sorts of things. And often the clues are in full view, but of course as the writer too, part of the problem is for me they're perfectly obvious. They're screaming, of course it's the salt and pepper shaker. But you know, but you do it among, you mentioned there on the table is the salt and pepper shaker, and there's the butter, and by the way it has nothing to do with salt, I'm just using it as you know, but you mentioned five things, and the reader doesn't know whether any of those things is significant, or if one of them is, and which one, and whether it is the one that Gamache picks up, or whether it's the one that young Agent Nickel focuses on.
Right.
But you know that all the clues are there, so that at the end, if you go back and reread the story, you think, oh my God, there it was, and now it's obvious. I mean, in some of them I almost even say it.
Yeah, it's so clear then. You know, it's like looking at one of those pictures that has hidden objects in it, and then once someone points it out, it's so obvious.
Yeah, and then you can't not see it.
Right.
And it is fun. I love doing the misdirection.
Do you feel that it's much easier to write a mystery from multiple points of view?
I do. I wouldn't know how to write one. Although I just wrote a novella for literacy, actually, and I decided it was probably the best way to tell the story, because it had to be very short, was to tell it just from one point of view, and that was, of course, Gamache's. But I love multiple points of view, because part of what a mystery is the duality, the public face and the inner voice and the inner reality, and the gap that exists often between the facade and the reality. And we get a glimpse of that when we are allowed to see different points of view, and we see people from the outside, and then we see that other person from the inside. Mm-hmm. And so we see the perception and then the reality.
And one thing that I thought must be a bit difficult that you do really well is you show us what these various people are thinking. And everything that they're thinking, goes along with the truth of the book, but you're not necessarily letting us know who done it right away.
Thank you.
And then if you were to go back and read it again, you'd suddenly say, oh, well, this person who done it is thinking these things, and that makes perfect sense, but I didn't think it was obvious.
That's right, because there could be different interpretations.
That must be kind of hard to do.
It is, and that's where editing comes in.
Yeah,
I was very lucky because I was a journalist for many years, and I loved editing. I was a radio journalist, so I edited, and it was at the time before
for the CBC,
digital,
correct?
For the CBC. Yeah. That's right. So I actually physically held the tape, and you cut it on a diagonal, and you put the thing in, and then you listen. Sometimes you're taking breaths out, and I loved the whole thing. So I'm a big fan of editing, and I understood the benefit of it and the power of editing. And some writers build stories from the ground up, and they do it. They're meticulous in their thought and their planning, and like a sculpture, and they just bring out little bits of clay, and they add, and they add, and they add. Whereas I don't. My first drafts are just a real dog's breakfast. People's names change, and the story changes, and it can be just a real mess. But what I do is I just throw everything at it. So I've got this lump of clay.
Right.
So, and then I edit.
So your revision tends to bring the page number down?
Yes.
Okay.
Hugely down. Well, it depends. I'm getting a little better now because I'm a little clearer, I think, of what I'm doing and what I want to say and how to say it. So I have fewer dead ends now in my first draft. But I would say by the third or a quarter, I bring it down.
Mm-hmm. And The Brutal Telling is the fifth in the series?
It is,
okay.
Yes.
Are you working on number six?
I'm just finishing number six.
Oh, how exciting.
Wow. I love it.
Now, I remember reading that when you stopped working as a journalist, you first tried to write a historical novel. I'm curious if you ever want to go back and look at that historical novel, or if you've just decided that's not your future.
I actually have thought about that recently. I don't think it is my future, but I clearly would do a better job of it now than I did then. Well, which wouldn't be hard because I didn't actually write it then. So I it was the wrong book, and I got myself all stressed out, and it's in my personality to, and this is not a good part of my personality, to feel that if I'm not going to be the best at something, then why bother? And I don't start out, it's not consciously part of, but I think I'm very competitive. Mm. And I hold myself to a higher standard than is reasonable or healthy. And it certainly didn't serve my purposes here, where I think I forgot to write with joy and to write with gratitude and to write for the pleasure of it. Instead, I was writing so that other people would applaud, or at least trying to write. And as a result, I ground to a halt. I was frozen with fear. It was also the only thing I ever wanted to do from the time I was eight. And I think I was afraid that in putting it to the test, I would be found wanting. And so I was just very nervous about that and needed to hit it out of the ballpark in the first draft and felt that the first draft needed to be perfect, which of course was ridiculous. The whole thing was ridiculous. So I've since given myself a lot of slack and realized that if I tried to be perfect in the first draft, there would be no inspiration. There wouldn't be any of those, oh my God, where did that come from? I would be holding on so tight.
Mm-hmm.
So to get back to the historical thing, it was the wrong book. It was the wrong book for the wrong reason. Just the whole series of things led to 5 years of writer's block.
Oh dear. Now you mentioned 8 years old.
Yes.
What happened when you were 8 years old? Ah. That was the moment.
I read Charlotte's Web.
Oh, which is mentioned in this book.
Yes.
Quite a lot, yes.
Which is really, and when this book came out, I have the best publisher in the world, Minotaur Books, and Hope Dellen, who's my editor there. When The Brutal Telling came out, which, as I say, does mention Charlotte's Web, and she knows the story I'm about to tell her, I'll tell you after this one, she and her husband came to Montreal, and she gave me a first edition of Charlotte's Web.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
But, I mean, how wonderful is that to have a publisher who would do that?
Mm.
And the book was, Charlotte's Web was really important to me because at the age of eight, I was very afraid of spiders, like phobic. Very annoying, I'm sure, because I'd shriek and run. And I remember sitting in my bed. I remember the moment it came to me that I wanted to write a book, be a writer. I was reading Charlotte's Web. I was also a very isolated child, by my own choice, lonely. I wanted my own company. I only ever felt safe in my bedroom reading. So there I was in my bedroom reading Charlotte's Web. I think I might have also been a little slow, because it took me about halfway through Charlotte's Web to realize that Charlotte's a spider. And that I loved Charlotte. And that instant, that moment, I can feel it now, I can see it now. My fear of spiders disappeared, and it never returned. I mean, I don't seek them out, but if I see, I'm not afraid of spiders anymore. And from that moment, and I realized at that moment the power of the word to heal, and I wanted some of that. Of course, later, you learn about the power of the word to hurt as well, and the damage that can be caused by words. Anyone who says sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never harm me, has probably been on the launching end of a lot of very nasty words and not on the receiving end. Words can do unbelievable damage, but they can be amazingly healing as well. And so at that moment, I realized I wanted to write.
Well, to give you a break, I don't think Charlotte shows up for at least the first third of
the book. Thank you. Wilbur's pig. It was an imperfect lesson because I still eat bacon. So while Charlotte got off well, I don't kill spiders, but I'll eat bacon.
Are there very many mysteries set in Quebec, do you know?
In English, there are a few. There's a Robin Harlick who writes. She lives in Ottawa, but she writes in that across in the Outaouais area. Wonderful, wonderful mysteries. It has a native characters, and they're beautiful works. But I don't really know of others that actually set in Quebec.
I wasn't aware of a lot of others.
I think there may be some French ones, but frankly, I don't really, I haven't read.
Yeah, and you write in English.
I do.
Now, your book is, and I'm sure probably most of your books are do this, you have French words sprinkled through, because it's very real, it is the area. One of the examples here, on the outside he looked 70, but on the inside he was in good physical condition. This is the pathologist speaking. Then I looked at his clothes. They were clean, too, and mended. They were old and worn, but propre.
Propre.
You say it.
That's it. No, propre. You're perfect. Propre.
I just really enjoy that mixing in of the language of the culture with the language that I understand, and obviously I'm not going to understand all French, a book all in French, but it's just enough. How do you balance that so that it's just enough and it's not too much?
Well, that's interesting because... for some people it is too much, and I've had some emails from people saying that they don't understand the French and they find it upsetting.
See, I don't understand the French and I don't find it upsetting.
It seems to be in context.
So.
If I'm reading a book set in Italy and it's written in English but there are few Italian or Spanish, it is. It's context, it's scene setting. You realize they're probably not going to give you a major clue in a language you don't understand, but it is meant to just remind you that you are in a different culture. And you might even learn a little bit about how to speak some languages. But as a result, I've put on my website a pronunciation guide, and as part of that guide, because some people, it never occurred to me that quite naturally some people wouldn't know how to pronounce the main characters' names, like Gamache or Reine-Marie, his wife, or Beauvoir.
Right, and to some extent we do like to have that little audio playing in our head when we're reading, don't we?
Yes, and yeah. I did that with in terms of some of the French words, I explain in broad strokes what some of them mean. But they are meant to be simply scene setters. There's nothing of substance that I would ever put in a different language.
Now you mentioned your website, let's just say what it is.
It's louisepenny.com.
Great. What advice do you have for writers who occasionally get stuck in their work or have trouble moving forward?
Oh,
And you mentioned
I love
your,
that question.
Your own writer's
yes.
block. Yes.
No, and it's and so many writers, initial emerging writers, suffer from it. And I think, I suspect for many of the same reasons I did. As I said, one of the great breakthroughs for me was realizing I'm no different than anyone else. This is a piece of advice that I got actually when I was writing the second book, because I was afraid I would suffer from it again, writer's block, in the second book. So I went to a therapist and spoke to people about it, and a wonderful piece of advice I got from the therapist was that the wrong person was writing the book, which was unexpected advice.
Here, I'll give it to my
All
husband.
Right, yeah, that's right. I think my agent should be writing this book. What she meant was the critical me was writing the book, and that I need to thank the critic inside me and show her the door. Not lock the door, and you sure don't want to piss her off. You want to bless her and thank her. Leave her there, because her time will come. But your creative self needs to be in front of the whatever it is you write with. For me, it's a laptop. And as soon as she said that, I could feel the wisdom in it and the rightness of it. And that gave me permission then to write 10 pages on a rose if I want. Because I know in the edit, that's not going to stay in the edit. But at least I'm writing and I'm being creative. And out of that huge morass of words of my first draft, when I invite the critic back in, that's when we're going to find a lot
and
of the
work.
She can
filter through and do all
she
that stuff.
She can do that, but not the first draft. The critic should not be writing the first draft, because the critic is going to tell me that everything is crap, and even the good stuff, and make it impossible for me to really be as creative and explore as many roads as I want to. The other thing is, I was reading a book about a young Canadian who ran across the country, or tried to run across the country to raise money for cancer. He had had a leg.
I read about that.
Terry Fox.
Sierra Magazine, maybe. Anyway.
And he died. Yeah. This was about 20 years ago that he died. But a new book came out relatively recently about his diary, done from his diaries. And in it, his name was Terry Fox, he describes getting up every day, and that he didn't every day set out to run across the country, though he clearly knew what the goal was. All he did was he ran to the next corner, and then he ran to the next corner. And I could see that that's how I need to write my books. Every morning I don't get up to write a book. I get up to do the words for that day. Whatever goal I've set for myself, if it's 500 or 200 or 1,000, I don't run to the end of the book. I write the very best 1,000 words that day that I can. And that's relaxing too. So I just run to the next corner, and eventually I will get to where I need to be.
That's great advice.
Yeah,
I
thank
like
you.
I like that analogy too. It's wonderful.
I've been very lucky. I've been helped a lot along the way by people who know better than I do.
Yeah. Well, Louise, I think that we are out of time, but I want to thank you so much for speaking with me.
No, I have loved this. You've asked great questions. It's a real delight. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Louise Penny. You can learn more about her work at her website, which we just mentioned, but I'll say it again, louisepenny.com. She's just got a new website now. It looks really great. Today's Write the Book prompt is to write a poem or story about an invented fad. Invent a fictional trend and imagine that it has become wildly popular, and then write about what happens. A copy of this prompt will be included in the description to this week's podcast. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you are interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And a reminder, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. And we're ending a tiny bit early today. I'm going to put on the music that ends my show, and then I'll put on some music from the Vermont Music Library. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you are listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont.